Welcome to the Week in Sports Cars from the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and presented by my ever-trusty, ever-present co-pilot. Could he be my elf on the shelf? Could he be my Goodwin in the shed? That being DailySportsCar.com editor...
That's me. It's Graham Goodwin from the UK for once. That's a change. And lest we forget, and just so you know that I was paying attention this time, it's absolutely definitely not a shed, and certainly not this week, because you catch me in the comfortable surroundings of the Goodwin family home in our little conservatoire in the back of the house. And it's actually daylight for the moment as well, which means that we're capturing this rather earlier than normal. On this fine Wednesday evening.
And that is maybe worth mentioning all by itself. Of late, with you having traveled to the farthest regions of the Middle East, Asia, and you name it, the hunting for a time and a time zone that might work, whether it's late here in California, early wherever you've been, or vice versa, we've been hunting for times to record the show for about the past 4 or 5 weeks. It is awesome to have you home where we can get back to the norm. And then what do? We record earlier than ever Wednesday. So, good stuff. So, Graham, we're going to do something fun here for the first time on the Week in Sports Cars. A little bit of holiday giving back. Would you illustrate that and tell us how we're going to do, what we're going to do, and when it's going to happen?
Well, it's going to happen this week, and it's going to happen at least for the next couple of weeks, with thanks to my lovely friends at Skelextric. There was going to be a very lovely Skelextric car for the question of the week. That is the question that you and I have selected as being the one that we've enjoyed answering the most, MP. And there will be, there's three very lovely cars, looking at them right now. And I think depending on what the question's about, we'll make a determination about which of the three fabulous race cars are the one that's going to be going to the individual or individuals that actually pique our interest the most. So I'm delighted that we can do that.
I love that. I love that. So we will name that person and their question at the end of the show. And when we do so, please send either Graham or myself a direct message and tell us where you live, give us your mailing address and whatnot, and we will get you sorted with a lovely Skelextric sticks.
No problem.
Yes.
And of course, with a Week in Sports Cars, a little vinyl sticker as well.
Well, see, we're just giving stuff away, and
we're just like that.
I'm wide enough, and my beard is white enough for me to kind of be sports car Santa Claus. Ooh. Here. I'm liking where we're going, my friend. One of the great blessings that we have had, Graham, honestly, it's been almost a daily thing. Is although the show is not quite a year old, we're coming up on that anniversary in about 6 weeks or so, maybe seven. Is we seem to have more and more listeners every day, every week, and that is not only awesome, it also means that we are getting more questions every week, and we love those questions, especially since we shifted the format of the show to listener-driven items on the world of ACO, FIA, motor racing, IMSA, SRO, you name it. Our goal, which we fail at more often than not, and it's 100% my fault, is to keep the show around 90 minutes. So what we're going to do this week is stick to that very close 90-minute goal and know that we will not get to every question. But what we're going to do, because the holidays are almost upon us, is record a second show, which is strictly about getting to the rest of the questions. And we'll put that up later this week, maybe over the weekend. So bottom line, we want to make sure we get to all your questions here over the holidays. And since some of you will be looking for things to dull your mind in and around family members and whatnot, possibly during the holidays, maybe the two of us prattling on about Lord knows what will help get you there. So with that said, brother, where among our, what are we at, 9 pages of questions, where shall we start this week's fun fest?
Well, I think we should first and foremost say a big thank you to new, well, let's call a member of the team, young Ryan Kish from Fresno, who has been working with DSC for about a year or so now, been with us, and has helped us to put together this week's question. So thanks for that, Ryan. And we'll be expecting that on the hour, every hour from this point forward for the rest of your life. So let's go. Let's start with IMSA this week.
Okay, well, fair enough.
Do you want me just to, kind of fire these at you? Like a frenzied cannon?
Sure. Frenzied can hashtag frenzied cannon. Yes, we were already creating. We're content creators, social media creators, bad hashtags, Pruitt and Goodwin. It's a thing. Let's go.
Let's go with something I have to say wasn't absolutely immediately aware of. Darren Dubois contacts us via Facebook and says that he sees that Mike Conway isn't confirmed for Action Express at the 24 Hours. Rolex 24. Will he be with someone else?
I need to check in on this, Darren. I can mention this, and I can't put a whole lot on it, but I have heard that outside of the exception to Alonso and Kobayashi at Daytona, that Toyota might be a little more miserly than usual about making its drivers available elsewhere on the IMSA endurance calendar. You would, I mean, the obvious thing would be to say, well, hey, if those two Toyota drivers are going to be at Daytona, wouldn't Conway be as well? I need to check in and hopefully confirm with Action Express that Mike will indeed be part of that routine. I'd be surprised if he wasn't. The guy is so darn fast, and as we've seen, is often the fastest driver in that program at Daytona. Any goals of having him for any other rounds, that might be a little bit of a challenge. So I don't know if that could be something that has led to a little bit of a longer delay in confirming, but definitely a, sorry, bad pun or alliteration here, but a action item for Action Express that I need to check in on here.
Might be worth actually checking around here whether or not that in any way is linked into Toyota's plan test at Sebring, because we do know they plan to test before the WEC race around Sebring. They've never been there before. It might well be that that's part of the issue, because we do know that, I'm not wrong, am I, that some of those tests at Sebring have been pretty close to the Rolex 24 Hours in past years.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So it could well be something to do with that. Good stuff. It would be a shame if we do miss out on Mike. I can tell you, by the way, I just dropped this one in like a, you know, a glitter grenade, if you like. There is certainly one driver who has been named in a team that we know is going to do the Rolex 24 that will not be driving for that team, will be placed with a different team for the Rolex 24 Hours. Hopefully we can bring you that news in the coming days. Let's feed up another one.
Christophe Bouchoux.
No.
Okay. The world's most popular sports car driver.
He's right there up in the top million. Let's go with Matt Needer, another one from Facebook. To Matt's knowledge, neither the 33 Riley nor the 71 P1 Motorsports AMGs and GTD have been officially announced for their 2019 plans. Surely Ben Keating's returning, right? Any information on any of either of those two entrants, MP?
First of all, don't call me Shirley. I would say that there's not a surprise here in the fact that both are aligned with the same manufacturer, and I have yet to see an alert from that manufacturer as to all of its IMSA-related partners, friends, teams, drivers, etc. So I would say, Matt, no need to worry on that front. We will definitely see the aforementioned teams in play. Just the absolute point that you raised, you have not seen the official announcement, and that is one thing that has not come out yet, but we might not have the official announcement, but we know those teams are not sitting in the shop doing nothing waiting for that announcement, so they are working full steam ahead to get themselves to the roar before the 24 here in about 2 weeks.
Excellent. We've got another, well, GT question, GTD, GTLM, and this one around Aston Martin from John Foreman, one of our Twitter questioners. John asks, with Aston Martin having a full factory effort GT Pro in the WEC, the highly probable chance of seeing them with a two-car entry in car in 2021-22, is there any hope of them ever paying the manufacturer's fee to IMSA joining GTLM or with a pro-am effort in GTD? Says something nice about the podcast. Better be nice about that one then.
I know. John, I would never say never. We have had Aston Martin in IMSA. We have had some limited North American Endurance Cup playings on their behalf. Beyond that, at least as I have seen things most recently, and Graham, tell me if you agree, it would appear AMR and the obviously the parent company, Aston Martin, is looking at Europe at initial areas to focus on this big splash of beautiful new vehicles to compete with in GTLM. And also we still have the GTD/GT3 offering. So again, at least for right now, and unless I'm unaware that they've forked out the money to play in IMSA on, you know, in either of those classes, I would not say it's out of the scope of possibility. I just don't know if it's on their immediate horizon. So shifting immediate focus, I would say, Graham.
I think you're spot on. And I think that it is exactly that. It's a time-connected thing. They certainly were looking for a partner in North America, both to run a high-profile program, but also to help to service their customer base, and they hope an expanding customer base for their GT3 and GT4 products. That, I think, has been taken longer than they would have hoped, and they are being, there's a great word, sustainable about this. They don't want to kind of overplay their hand. What they absolutely don't want to do is to launch those products into the North American marketplace without the support network that other manufacturers already have in North America. That is the key that will eventually unlock Aston Martin coming and bringing high-profile efforts, I suspect, in all three classes at some point, with customers, of course, in at least two of them in North America, but not quite yet. I think that's a source of some disappointment to some within the company. But whether or not we will see the odd entry here and there, I think it remains to be seen. But one or two of the pieces in that jigsaw just didn't slot into place neatly enough for them to commit. So will we see an Aston Martin in competition in North America in 2019? I'm sure we will. I'm sure you will see the new Vantage in one or other of the classes in IMSA and or Pirelli World Challenge or whatever it's called this week. Let's wait and see just exactly who, when and where. They certainly don't yet have a partner organization in the way that they were looking to support their customer racing efforts. Okay, moving down. Stark Raven says, oh, he's asked this before without a reply. Outrageous of us.
We are human beings.
I certainly am. What does IMSA gain from the WC IMSA weekend at Sebring? Did the ACO FIA scam IMSA into thinking that DPIs would be allowed at Le Mans instead of the supercar spec? I see zero ROI for IMSA from sharing the 12-hour weekend. Start raving, being start raving there, and clearly shouting at the keyboard while he was doing it. MP, we may have a difference of opinion on this one.
Well, definitely time to drop a note to Sportscar 52 Weeks. We have a hashtag breaking exclusive scoop. Yes, this was negotiated along with the Trump Tower in Moscow. It is so tied in deep political skullduggery, our pal Stark Raving. From what I know, and I apologize we have not gotten to this question the first time or two you sent it through. We also request for those who really want us to get to your questions, if we miss them, please send them through again, and we'll get to them eventually. This one I've loved, and I apologize we haven't gotten to it before. Here's a couple things that I know, and I could not be proven entirely wrong. I know that the FIA WEC has gone to track at least one track in North America. We've mentioned before, Indianapolis Motor Speedway, met with its CEO, Doug Bowles, and said, hey, so we would love to race here. How much are you going to pay us? To which Doug said, I thought you were meeting to tell me how much you were going to pay us for the honor of racing here. Things broke down. Nothing happened. I would say in the case of Sebring, which is owned by or the rights to the facility, which happens to be owned by and in the care of IMSA/NASCAR, I would say this is very much of a money-making opportunity for them. compared to a, hey, how can we spend money to have the FIAWEC appear on the same bill as our world-famous Mobile One 12 Hours of Sebring? So in terms of it being a little bit of a weird thing, right? Not the traditional, hey, the headliner is IMSA and it's 12-hour race on Saturday, but if you come here Friday, we kind of also have a headliner. Normally there's the big act, and the other acts on the bill are definitely smaller and lesser in stature. Not the case here, where we have a big international sports car series racing on Friday, then the traditional big show on Saturday. Can definitely see how it appears as if the waters might be muddied, might be diluting, if anything, IMSA's presence there. I would just say that at a time where I know IMSA, IndyCar, NASCAR, just about every series in North America, Graham, is searching for any penny, any dollar from anywhere, because they're having to do budget cuts across the board, the idea of a promise, either a sanction fee from the FIAWEC, the promise of paying for a number of hospitality suites, which all of the major brands and major teams involved in the WEC would want, concession sales, catering, many things where income could be generated compared to being sent out. The thought of being able to double up in some capacity during the 12 Hours of Sebring weekend, I would say, is the underlying thing here. So that's the ROI. Am I saying it would be a huge return on investment? No. But I do think that there's a potential here for IMSA/NASCAR to make a little bit of extra money off this, which is why they did it.
Yeah, I think the other thing to say here is I can absolutely guarantee you there was absolutely no conversation whatsoever about this being a backdoor into DPIs coming to Le Mans. That's not been on the table for quite some considerable length of time. We've been through this before on the show, but that comes down to wanting manufacturers, if they're going to come to Le Mans, to be committing to the FIAWEC. And, you know, before we get into, but that's not fair, the reality is, of course, we have seen over the last couple of years, the ACO welcome the factory cars or the factory backed cars in GTLM to the Le Mans 24 Hours. So it's not, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Is there disagreements? Is there animosity? Is there that all that bad stuff between the two organisations? Well, on some occasions, there absolutely has been. On some occasions, bad words have been spoken. Words that if your children used them around the Christmas dinner table would certainly mean they'd be on the naughty list for the next Christmas. But on this occasion, business-led decision. You're absolutely right, MP. What's in it for the WEC? They get to hook into a established event in North America where they didn't want to go back to COTA. That wasn't working for them, and they were struggling for another event of stature to tick off the North American side of things. And I'm very happy that they've managed to do that. Be fascinated to see how this event actually works.
Absolutely.
Here's the next one. I need a name, please, from the USCR Reddit page. Asks, what's the status on any potential Rolex 24 entries from, he mentions, Jackie Chan DC Racing, RLRM Sport, Panis Barthes, Inter Europol, or indeed others? I can help you with a couple of those, MP.
Well,
I don't know where you are.
That's your world, brother, because, hey, I'm the IMSA guy by and large. You are the FIAWEC, ELMS, Asian Le Mans Series expert, and I would not dare trample on your ground.
The ones we definitely know have declared, at least publicly, they're doing it are the Dragon Speed effort with two Orica Gibsons. RLRM Sports, I believe, are still lining up for what would be a third Orica Gibson coming from the European side of things. I can tell you that I think there's about zero chance of Jackie Chan DC Racing being there. The Panis Barthes team, certainly not heard that they've declared that that's what they want to do. They have just changed their season plans, and that might have an effect on the Rolex 24, in that they've just announced effectively that they will be doubling up in the European Le Mans series with a pair of Ligiers. And I can also tell you, because this one's not been out there either, so this is a breaking exclusive scoop, is that Inter-Europol's North American program will be delayed a tad. That's them coming to terms with the step up that they've got, plus the fact that probably against their expectations, they are very much in contention for a championship win and therefore a automatic Le Mans place via their efforts in the Asian Le Mans series. So that's something that is, because they're currently leading the championship in LMP3, which would allow one of their Ligiers an auto entry to Le Mans if they manage to sustain that progress. So will there be others emerging? There might be. I don't expect it's going to be a very large number. I think there's still a possibility of at least one Dallara team stepping forward, but it's fair to say that some of the initial interest that was being shown maybe the middle towards the end of last year seems to be kind of spluttering a bit now with the economic realities that are hitting teams. This is not a cheap race to do. It's a very long way to come, and their cars will be in transit for quite a long time. So I'm afraid one of the net results is going to be that initial idea that the split LMP2 class might attract a reasonably large number. There will be teams of quality there. There will be some international interest with those teams, but it's not going to be the kind of numbers that I think we initially were hoping for, were briefed that there might be. I think you're going to be looking at pretty small numbers.
And if Inter-Europol is going to be delayed, might I suggest that one of my favorite bands, Interpol from New York, actually just enter somehow with a car, maybe a performance on pit lane. I'm not sure what. There are options, though.
Wouldn't be the first time we'd have rockers, of course, on the Rolex 24 with Brian Johnson and the excellence that was the DP program for those guys, the over 50s guys. Let's have a quick look. Adam J. Sharp, another one from the SCR group on Reddit, says, is there a chance IMSA will eliminate LMP2 entirely if only two cars will be competing for the full season?
Great question, Adam. There will be no deletion of LMP2 this season. If we are headed towards 2020, though, and if we're in that same minimal two full-time entry type scenario we're facing this year, although the PR1 Matheson and Performance Tech teams do tell me they think there's a possibility of a third. Not sure if that would be starting out the season, meaning they would be the full season from the outset, but possibly joining on early into the season and remaining until the end. They hope there might be a third. I would say that the answer that Scott Atherton gave me on the subject, which was IMSA's is very proud of its track record of doing what it says it will do, and in this case, splitting off into an LMP2 category this season, that tells me that they're absolutely committed to it, even if one of the steps on the podium is maybe empty at some rounds. Going into next year, I would say, Adam, if that doesn't improve, very, very possible, which could, yeah. I don't want to think about that right now, because I know how ugly it has been trying to balance P2s and DPIs, and you know that saga's played out over 2 years, and no one has been happy on either side when the other one has been successful. The last thing I'll mention here, Adam, very quickly, is while we're looking at 2 to 3 this year, maybe, both PR1 Matheson and Performance Tech tell me they are very encouraged for 2020 and thinking that, yeah, this is going to be the rough year to get through. But again, their indicators, they didn't maybe fully flesh out what those points of positivity were attached to. But both told me they thought 2020 could be a year where actually the P2 grid starts to pick up quite a bit. So at least for those in the paddock making it happen with the cars, their mindset is let's get through a lean 2019, and then in theory things will be getting better the following year. And if that's the case, then it's a non-topic. And before we move on to another IMSA question, Graham, using my little fat fingers to typity type on my phone. I have just learned that, yes, possibly before this podcast even goes up, one Michael Conway of the United Kingdom will be confirmed as an Action Express racing driver. So, hey, the first question where I needed to get info, look at that. Took us a little bit of time, but we done got it, Darren Dubois. So, see, we're not as dumb as I think we be.
Well, I wonder if, should we move on to something else? Bearing in mind, we're going to use this same question set and anything else that's posted in the meantime, by the way, to feed into this this Christmas New Year special. Let's move on and do some WEC stuff now. And if we do get a chance at the end of the 90 minutes, there's a couple of very good questions that I know we'll be catching up with. So it's time for you to play the mixed doubles, the US side to my European side, and start serving me some bad boy questions.
Ooh, you're all, you know, as a former male stripper, that bad boy persona of yours, Goodwin, it just keeps coming out. All right. You and young Stephen Kilby, one of your other dailysportscar.com Jedis, had a great story that posted earlier this week. It's only Wednesday, so there's not a whole lot of early in the week, I guess. But great story earlier this week about Ferrari. A little constructor, I've heard, Modena, something like that. Marianello, yeah. I'm not sure. Adam Smith.
I always thought it was an ice cream flavor, but I'm clearly wrong.
Their gelato is fantastic. Our pal Adam Smith from Facebook says, how serious are Ferrari about joining the WC hypercar ranks? Is this something they have started? Or could they bow out before 2020? So what do you think?
I'll be honest with you. I thought long and hard about
writing, is a family show.
long and hard about writing the story that I did. I can tell you that is a story that has developed pretty radically over the last several weeks. I've been sitting on lots of information, some of which is not contained in the story. That is not everything I know about this. But I've been thinking long and hard about when we should just take the covers off it. The answer is, look, number one, Ferrari were in the room throughout those technical negotiations. I know there was a bit of a wrong-footed report elsewhere about the fact that they'd left the table. They hadn't. They may not have attended every single meeting, but they've been very serious about what's coming from this. There are lots of things about Carcar that play very much to Ferrari's current agenda, not all of which are immediately obvious. There is a common theme which will be developed when you start to hear who else is involved in active negotiations about bringing cars to the WEC and to Le Mans 24 Hours in 2021, 2022 particularly. So watch this space. That's not it. That is one corner of this story. It's not the story. The story is much, much better than that. So how serious do I think they are? I think they're very, very serious. I think if you were to ask me to put a percentage on their likely program at the moment, it would be somewhere north of 75%. What I've been briefed by at least two sources, again, none of which are linked into the rulemaking body or the race organizing body, so it's industry sources, is that the key point here is the final technical regulations and whether or not this program can be delivered for within the window that Ferrari are interested in. There's lots of reasons why this is of interest to Ferrari, not just the promotional side, hanging on to their own talent, influencing regulations moving forward. There's all sorts of things that that it's well worth listening to and reading those that understand the nuances and the politics involved in racing this level. How serious do I think they are? I think they're deadly serious. And just to put that into context, we're talking here about the potential for the first ever Ferrari factory entry in frontline sports cars from the factory in my adult lifetime. I think that would be a spectacular story. And to add to, because Adam follows up, doesn't he, with another question, who would drive the Ferrari hypercar? Well, I think you've got two sorts of possibilities there, don't you? You've got the massively talented people that are in their current GT squad, many of whom have got very recent high-level single-seater experience, so the likes of Sam Bird, James Collado, etc., Davide Rigon, or indeed, I think they're involved in another sort of form of racing, aren't they? Am I counting out that Formula One drivers for the Ferrari factory team might be seen at the Le Mans 24 Hours at least? I'm absolutely not. Am I telling you that that's the plan? I'm absolutely not. But I would say this. If you were the Ferrari factory team and you had no clash and this was a factory program, the first that you fielded since, what, late 60s, early 70s, wouldn't you be using your brightest and your best, both in terms of the technical staff and in terms of the people at the wheel? You remember what I said a few weeks ago on the show, MP, about we could be looking at something spectacular. We could be looking at something we've not seen, for many, many years. You're beginning to start to see the first offerings of what that vision might very well emerge as being. Are we there yet? No. Are we getting closer by the day? Yes. Over to you, the people writing these regulations. And I'll just say this. Don't cock it up.
Oh, well, on the topic of drivers, I would say for Le Mans, leave me alone. I know what to do. That would be a good one, even if he's been farmed out to Sauber. So let me ask, this is a little Weekend Sports Cars follow-up. Would you anticipate, dear Mr. Goodwin, as the person who has had conversations with folks in the know at this lovely Italian constructor or in or around this constructor, if a hypercar prototype-ish program would be more along the lines of what we have seen for many years in GTE, for example, GTE Pro, of, no, it is not a full works Ferrari team. We are not here as a upfront full factory team, but we have affiliates, we have partners, our name's on the car, it's red, it's amazing, but no, Maranello is not turning up this weekend, an AF Corsa type team or related. We would rather go the non-direct factory route. You think that might be the mindset?
No, every single conversation I've had, and there have been a pretty large number of conversations with a pretty large number of individuals, indicates nothing other than a full factory program.
Ooh, I love it. I love it. All right. Well, Mr. Answering Assassin, let's move on since you've knocked out both from Edom and go to, Asian Le Mans Series is a place that is just dear to your heart. So we're going to go to Doug Bonham. Yeah. He says, question for GG. With a few weeks to digest the first two rounds, are there any big shocks with the Asian Le Mans series this season? And also, how charmed was the car guy to come back from the early setback only to win the class?
Thanks, Doug, for that. I'm enjoying it thoroughly. So we're two of the four races now under the wheels of the cars.
And I meant not a car guy, not car. Apologies.
Car guy. But it was funny, though. Funny you this week. The first pleasant surprise was the number of European teams coming to play and raising the bar for the Asian Le Mans grid. The big surprise was the quality of the drivers that were arriving with that. I think we said from day one there was barely a car on the grid that doesn't feature a champion of some sort, and we're talking world champions with James Collado and Alessandro Pierguidi, European champions Andrea Pizzitola, Asia Le Mans Series champions, Le Mans champions Dries Van Ter, blah blah blah, etc. etc. For me, there's no big shocks. The biggest surprise for me has been the form book in LMP3. And I think that's been quite a shocker to a couple of the established order as well. So it is the Inter-Europol team who had a conversation with a very established player in LMP3 just 24 hours ago about this. This is you know, not a fancy team. It's a team that that people who watch the European Le Mans series will be aware of. Johnny Palmer and I regularly refer to Inter Europol as the Norwich City Ligier because it's got the football colours of Norwich City, the bright yellow and bright green. But they've been a kind of coming force. I'd say this much. I think their form has actually surprised the team as well. I was told to lower my level of expectation for Fuji, and they were there again, not in qualifying, but in the race. So that little team has certainly been a surprise to me. I think we will see a little bit more recovery in the numbers for the other two races. I think we'll see some one-off entries. It is a shame that we didn't see the Jackie Chan DC Racing team return. There are a couple of reasons behind that, some of which are commercial, some of which were logistical. But I think we're at a point where we've got a sustainable level for that championship. I'm delighted to be a part of a move to make that much more accessible and much more commercially valuable to the people taking part in it. And I know the numbers are amazing in region for the people following that race online, following the TV coverage that we go with. I think now the task for Cyril Teichval and his team is about making sure that they keep the formula relevant and correct in what is a changing situation in Asian motorsport, what is a changing marketplace in sports car racing, to make sure that we keep those grid numbers healthy moving forward. So no big surprises, but we've had a couple of brilliant races. I mean, Fuji in particular was a great race.
I could not disagree based on the highlights package that I watched, and I hate to admit that, but yes, highlights only for me on that one, unfortunately. But I did stay dry. It did rain a little. The monitor rained a little bit, but other than that, let's go to John McCarthy, who has a great question from Twitter, and this is definitely in the area of opinion, but I'm curious if you've heard anything on the background. John says, will hashtag car, hypercar, sound the death knell to manufacturers in the GT category, GTE Pro, and will GT become a category just for privateers? Not necessarily immediately in 2020, but do you think, Graham, that this manufacturer-themed prototype class, once it gets rolling, could be a thing that diverts enough interest from manufacturers with their production-based race cars in GTE Pro to say, yeah, hey, let's just step it up and go full-bore top class and leave the stuff behind? I mean, I don't like the idea of hypercar and GTE AM as the result of this shift in regulations. Do you think we might get there?
I think it's a great question, and it's absolutely one of those questions that we don't yet know the answer to. I have spoken to more than one of the manufacturers involved, both in the talks about car and in GTE, GTLM, and it's a very active subject of discussion at the moment. What I would say, what's a pretty common theme with those manufacturers, is a fair degree of confidence that if they did shift their factory program to LMP1, let's call it that, or car, that there might very well be sufficient commercial interest in doing something with a factory-blessed effort in the GTE Pro, GTLM product to continue that. Now, remember, there is a regulation at the moment, the WEC, that says you can't have more than two cars for each of the manufacturers. So that means that, for instance, let's say for the sake of arguing that emerging force in GT racing decides that, well, you know what, we'd like a couple of those. Let's say Proton Competition wanted to step up to GT Pro. The reality is at the moment, with the Porsche factory team there, they can't do that. Who's to say that that's not something that might be a thing? So the reality at the moment is it's absolutely a relevant question to ask. The reality at the moment is we don't yet know what the answer might be. So, and it may very well be a very different answer depending on which mark we're talking about. So for instance, I cannot believe there would be a shortage of high profile teams, particularly in Europe, that might want to attempt at least to field a factory blessed effort for Ferrari, for Porsche. I know of at least two that might very well be interested in doing exactly that. And one of the reasons why that might be a thing is because of the business model that is often taken from these blue chip makes to sell these cars. These are cars that are extremely expensive. They're also extremely valuable, particularly if they've got provenance, if they've got racing heritage behind them. Aston Martin Racing, for instance, one of their business models has been for many years that the cars you see racing in factory hands very often are not owned by Aston Martin. They're owned by investors in that program. And that's certainly the case with other racing programs around the world. That could very well be one of the features that features in the future with GT Pro or GTLM Racing. So is there an open question? John, you're absolutely right, there is. Is there an answer yet to that question? I think we're about a year away from finding that out once we actually know who's going to step up and do take part in the top class.
Interesting. Let's see. Where shall we go? And again, it's looking at what should we use for our 90-minute-ish show now, and what should we save to come back to for our little holiday extra. Let's jump down to CM-16 at CMParfait16 from Twitter. Do you guys miss the era of 2016 and earlier LMP2s, where there were plenty of chassis varieties ranging from Lola to Arrecca to Ligier, and also SMP Racing's purposely built BR01, compared to only four approved manufacturers today? And I'll just tack on four approved, but there's only three in actual motion. Yep. And of those three, two dominate the market. What do you think, yep, Graham? Do you miss the old days of just run what you brung type P2?
I do. I mean, you know, those people that follow, our commentary on these things, in particular what I've been written about in Daily Sports Car, will remember I was a critic of what actually happened. I think it was the wrong motivation. And I think it was a wrong turn. It's not to say that the current cars aren't fantastic. They are. They are fantastic pieces of engineering. And to put that into context, let's not forget that the fastest of those LMP2 cars with the dual-like Gibson engine are quicker than, and you name it, a long, long list of factory LMP1s and LMP900s have been around the Le Mans 24-hour circuit. These are quick, quick cars. They may be a little too quick. But do I miss the era? I do. Happily, I've got at least another year beyond this year to enjoy at least some of them, because we've now had the confirmation from the Asian Le Mans series that their LMP2 AM class will continue in 2019-20 at the moment with the older pre-2017 cars, but that we will see the Gibson cars coming in for the Pro AM, the lead class. I know why they did it. I understand the reasoning behind it. They were concerned that we were getting to the point where someone could build that million-dollar LMP2 and dominate a class. The irony is that neither of the cars that they were concerned about, that being the aforementioned SMP BR01, nor the Dome that Strakker Racing sought and failed to bring into regular competition, neither of those were successful. So I think the answer here is, yes, I miss it. I think those cars were plenty quick enough. I think they certainly had life in those old dogs for some considerable time. Probably that we could have been looking at around the time that car was coming in, where that replacement might have been more relevant. But we are where we are. And I will say this, all credit to Gibson for the engine program. 50 of those 4.2-litre V8s are in existence on a lease system, with kind of rotation of those engines around the teams around the world, with, I think I'm right, it's something like 30-plus Gibson-powered LMP2 cars in operation at the moment, the vast majority of which are in regular competition. There's the odd spare chassis kicking around, and there's one Orica that has so far not raced in the hands of a team that races GT cars that have been using it effectively as a training and track day car. But the vast majority of those cars are being raced hard, raced seriously, and in very many cases successfully. But yeah, I think the era changed too quickly, but we are where we are.
I will add in the one thing I miss, not only among the variety maybe this is a little bit of a retro Pruitt, you're a dinosaur. I miss the open top P2 cars and P1 and GT cars where we didn't have very shallow angles on windshields and or all kinds of coatings and anti-reflective coverings and whatnot. I do miss the era, which now appears to be gone, maybe forever, being able to see drivers work inside the car, see their hands moving freely, see their head, their helmet moving, the helmet being affected by G-forces and braking, just a more dynamic visual presentation. Obviously, through in-car cameras and other things, we can get a feel for some of that, but just as a spectator, I know we're safer with closed cockpit, everything, I get all that, just the visceral side. That's the only thing I miss from the previous P2 formulas on the specific topic of having some open-top cars and feeling like, oh, cool, I can see these artists at work. It's kind of become a little bit more numb for me where we see vehicles moving around, but not always a direct connection to the fact that there's a human being inside stabbing at the controls.
Tend to agree. I can remember being taken around Road Atlanta the first time I went there and being taken to a couple of points where you could look down into the car and see the driver at work. There's not many world circuits where that's possible in the Class 1 European era. But yeah, I do miss that. I miss that a great deal. But there we go. It is a brave new world. And, you know, for all sorts of reasons, safety being one of them, I think, you know, we are now into the position where, frankly, at least we've got something that aesthetically looks as good as these cars do, as opposed to something like Halo. I get it. I understand the safety concerns. I just don't like a car that looks like a flip-flop or a thong, as our Australian cousins would tell us. But the reality is, I think what we've got at the moment, within the rules that we've got, are relatively pretty cars.
Aw, pretty, pretty cars.
Pretty is a great, great word.
We have three questions in the same vein from our pal Stuart Hart at Jag Le Mans, and also our pal Right Turn Lover at Right Turn Lover. Mm. So let me combinate. We're using non...
That's it. That's your word of the week.
Yes, my non-word of the week. Let me combinate the three. What's the prospects for privateers and hypercar year one, given we're still 18 months away from the opening race? Are we still expecting the likes of Rebellion, SMP, Dragon Speed, and Baikalis to be ready? And also, Stuart says, obviously reliant on customer chassis, be it the usuals like Areca, Onroke, Dallara, or new options, could we see teams like Signatec Alpine and DC Racing make the step up? And then Right Turn Lover adds similar, any idea on what an SMP or Rebellion might do in the car era?
I think there's a lot of open questions beyond the questions that are being asked there by Right Turn Lover and Stuart. And a lot of those are around. We don't yet know what's going to happen with potential factory entries for year one. We think that Toyota will be there. We know Jim Glickenhaus, I know you had a cracking podcast with Jim last week, MP, that Jim is looking to get there, but it's a tall order for year one. So a lot of those privateer teams that you're mentioning, I think we'll be waiting to see what happens in terms of grandfathering. No doubt in my mind, I know of at least a couple that are already talking to potential partners for what might be their efforts into the car era. It does give opportunities for some of those high-profile privateer teams to make a bit of a step forward, to get themselves to where there's no doubt a lot of these guys want to be, which is that they'll be very much more in the focus of the bigger factories for potentially future programs, future customer programs, etc. So lots of machinations at the moment. Add into that the fact that we've got those chassis manufacturers that in the DPI era are now set up to do something they weren't doing before. What do I mean by that? It's a conversation I had with a journalistic colleague 6-8 months ago, and it went somewhere along the lines of, look, you could legitimately write today that every single OEM, auto manufacturer, active in the North American marketplace today, you could actually say legitimately they are evaluating a DPI program, because they will be evaluating a DPI program because they'll have been sent a program to evaluate by one or more of those chassis manufacturers, because that's their business now in the United States. It's about trying to corral a manufacturer into running with their chassis. And they won't have forgotten that skill set in this era. They will be looking for the opportunities that are actually around to get themselves involved with either a mainstream manufacturer or a more boutique manufacturer and a privateer backer. And something like Rebellion Racing, I think, is the absolute target for these regulations for two reasons. It is the relative, and all things are relative, accessibility of the budgets. And yes, I know $16 million is a lot of money for a two-car program for a year's racing, but it's not a lot of money if you can stick to the promise that the cap is not on the expenditure, the cap is on performance. And if you spend at the level that they're telling us that are going to be possible to produce a competitive car, you will be ultimately competitive. So that all of a sudden is a different era for a boutique manufacturer and potentially a mainstream sponsor for that kind of effort. That means not only are you going to race in the top class at Le Mans, but you could win at Le Mans and in the FI World Endurance Championship. That is the ROI, if you like. Second mention of that. We've not done BOP yet, but ROI's got its second mention. That is the ROI that I think people right now are doing a lot of number crunching. And I'll tell you right now, there'll be an awful lot of PowerPoint work going on in the next 6 to 8 months, and an awful lot of people banging on the door of the commercial departments, marketing departments, PR departments, motorsport departments of all sorts of organizations worldwide to see whether or not they can't be talked into pointing their budgets in the way of endurance racing. How successful are they going to be? I think we've got excitement and disappointment probably in equal measure to come in terms of who will come into that marketplace and who will fall out of that marketplace in the next 12 to 18 months.
I am going to go with one here. See, you opened the door in your own. You done brought this on top yourself, my friend. Mark Bowley asks via Twitter, assuming Ferrari come to play in the WEC with a hypercar, will they be able to use their Formula One engine and energy recovery system? He says they already make at least 18 F1 power units each season that are lifed for 50 hours of running. Adding in engines for the WEC would bring them close to the minimum 25, and that being for year one. So, yeah, I hadn't really thought about that angle.
Well, it brings us back into that. You remember the Global Race Engine? Remember that?
Yes, GRE.
I don't know enough, I'll be honest with you, about the capabilities of the F1 power plants or powertrain to know whether or not that would fall anywhere close to being in the window. I think the honest answer, because there's got a couple of other questions, some of which we'll get to here and some of which we'll hang on over to the Christmas special, that are asking about what will be acceptable and what won't. As always, I think you've got to wait and see what emerges and what level of pragmatism might have to be employed. So let's put it this way. If, you know, come the 2nd of January, when the ACO get back and, you know, wipe away the Duck l'Orange from the corners of their mouths and get back to the serious work of building a grid, if when they get there, they find an orderly queue of major manufacturers from around the world waiting to hand over their proposals, then no worries. If, however, they're having to find a solution in year one into year two, if one or two of the highly potential programs turn to dust, then pragmatism might have to come into these things. I think, you know, as a little bit like we saw with the confusion about what that bit of wording in the original French meant and what that bit of wording meant, I think you will find there is room for pragmatism here about building a grid. They know that they're now in a position today, the remainder of this season, next season, and possibly season one, where they've got to grit their teeth and get on through it. They equally well know that there is a massive opportunity into the next, into the current, the new rule set, and then beyond that, into the planned efforts to get into a zero emissions formula or option for 2024, 2025, that they can see, they can smell, I'm sure, the opportunities that are actually in place there. What happens in the meantime, I think, is going to depend absolutely 100% on who comes forward and presents not the kind of story that we've given you on Daily Sports Car, but a real program now. It's all very well us telling you what's out there as a possibility and a probability, but that's not somebody putting their money down on the table saying, show us your cards.
We're getting close to the hour mark here, Graham, on the lovely Week in Sports Cars, so why don't we take one or two more from our ACO FIA related world, and then why don't we switch over to general to close. And I'm trying to do a very good job of highlighting the questions we are using, which leaves us a fine list of those that we will get to in our bonus episode in a matter of days. Let's see. Okay. At Safety Phil from Twitter, we might have an early candidate for the Scalextrics prize here. Does asking this for the fifth time win a prize for my tenacity? Question mark. I'm sorry, Phil. We suck. I've read the WC sporting regs a few times now and can't see any option than running all 1,000 miles of Sebring no matter what. This referring to the 2019 event there. Can't wait for a barrier rebuild and a bit of yellow to start to slightly annoy TV directors worldwide. So sounds like Phil is definitely concerned that the quote mandatory 1,000 mile completion might just push in farther than desired into the prep time and otherwise for not only the 12 hours of Sebring IMSA race the following day, but for all the behind the scenes stuff that needs to happen to switch over from a different WEC racing format to IMSA.
Well, let's wait and see. Supplementary regulations are wonderful things. Equally well, you also need to look at how long you'd have to run a race until you can flag that race and full points can be given. So that don't count that one either. But clarity will be there, I'm sure, by the time, well before we get to the place just alongside the orange groves. Generally speaking, in the TV era, we've had a pretty clear steer on when TV will have to finish. But remember, for the vast majority of outlets, we're talking about online streaming. And whilst, yeah, that might annoy a TV director, it wouldn't be the first time I've done something that's annoyed a TV director, or the second, or the third, or the fifth, or the 12th. But the reality is, it's less of an issue now in terms of the TV than it probably ever has been. So yes, there will be some TV partners that will need to plan around those potential things, but for streaming, doesn't matter. Internet's still open. It's not like we're waiting for another race afterwards. So I'm less concerned about that. And my guess will be there will be clarity about what we can expect. Remember as well, though, there is the other part of the equation for the 1,000 miles of Sebring, which is that the 1,000 miles of Sebring doesn't attract standard points. It attracts standard points plus. And in order to attract standard points plus, you've got to cover more of a distance than you otherwise would in a six-hour race. So There's all sorts of factors that I think we will need to see in the final regulations for that race. I'm pretty sure they've actually got a plan, and they tend to be, I have to tell you, pretty good in terms of the way they run the races at contingency planning. Maybe not so much in terms of the way they've developed regulations in terms of what we're going to see on track, but about the way the races are run. They have a very good team that are very experienced indeed in trying to make sure that we see the maximum level of entertainment.
I'm going to go ahead, Graham, and say for those of you who are devout to whichever religion, if you have a feeling inside you where you want to donate to those in need, let's start thinking about our pal Rooftop Ray. who might up being the lone TV camera operator at Sebring who does 1,000 miles on Friday. Probably just keep him up 20, 30 feet in the air on the lift overnight, maybe. Who knows? We'd just leave the camera on. Even though there's no racing, maybe he'll be filming the
He loves it.
And then pick up another 12 hours. So say a prayer for our pal Ray Wenzel Jr. Think about some sort of Venmo, GoFundMe, something. Get him drinks. I don't know what, but we need to think about Ray. He's probably going to be filming the entire thing, possibly nonstop. So we
love
Ray.
I'm hoping they're going to hang him underneath the B-17 that visited. that would be something, wouldn't it? A bouncing Ray.
Dangle Ray from beneath the helicopter. Yeah, I love that. See? Why is there vomit raining down from hundreds of feet? Hey, Ray, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, Ray.
Oh, Lord. All right.
It brings a whole new meaning to the phrase green, 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 doesn't it? There you go.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Let's go with our final WEC-related question to our pal, Rick Radica. Rapid Rick, who is a massive fan of sports car racing, and it's just always awesome when you get to see him. Rick sends us in via Twitter. He says, what do you guys think about 24 Hours of Le Mans, IMSA, the WEC? What do you think about them making three drivers mandatory and five for endurance races mandatory to assist budgets and really support bringing added talents to the sport? And I would assume that Rick is referring more to the Pro-Am classes than obviously the full factory classes. But do you think that could be, do you think that would be a worthy consideration to mandate a higher minimum of drivers in the hope that some would be bringing budgets? Or do you think the crafty, quote, sneaky silver workaround might be a thing where actually just added mandatory drivers traditional rounds, say, and even the endurance events might just end up speeding up the show instead of lining pockets with money?
It's an interesting question. I think, to be honest with you, one of the things I quite like about endurance racing is that we're never quite sure who's going to be racing some of these cars until we actually get to the track. It has been a thing for many, many years to, you know, nail down what the actual entry list is going to be. I mean, famously back in the day at the Rolex 24 Hours, you would wander around the paddock, check whose name's on the car, check with the team, go back the following day, and there'd be another 15 changes. In the days where I was commentating on the Nürburgring 24 Hours, we were regularly making somewhere between 40 and 60 changes to the entry list, on arrival, and several more before we got the final list on the Friday. So I think you can over-regulate. Bear in mind that the experts in this regard are not the FIA, they're not the ACO, they're not IMSA, they're not the individual drivers either. They are the professional race teams that have made a business out of filling those cars. They should be the ones that come forward with the deliverable suggestions as to what any regulation should say. They will know just how tough it is to actually make sure that a LMP2 car, a GT car, an LMP1 car for that matter, is populated by worthy talent that is producing the required funding with whatever package they've put together to put those cars on track. So I'm perfectly happy to hear the views of men in suits and, you know, the likes of us yabbering into microphones. But the reality is I don't have to do this for a living to put 2, 3, 4 or 5 guys or girls into a car and then, you know, make sure that money is delivered to make sure it happens again and again and again. My view is there's only one view that's worthwhile here, and that is the view of the professional race teams.
I would also like to suggest that while I know that the acronym changes a little bit depending on the country, that we just start using the Germanic, Icelandic, Swedish driver Tobias Bjork Danielsson, a.k.a. TBD, as just the mandatory slot in for any questions. So it would hopefully just lead folks to wonder, how is good old Tobias driving 40 cars or 60 cars? you know, would just drop that name in and really confuse the hell. I mean, John Winter, unfortunately, is no longer here, so we don't have any other real famous fake names. But yeah.
We did have one at the weekend. We had one at the weekend. And I'm just trying to think which car he was in. Where the heck was it at the weekend? That's right. I was at the Gulf 12 Hours. Almost won, by the way, by the fabulous new McLaren 720S. 10 hours of fault-free running and then a damper failed on it. But we did have a... of all things, a Ferrari 458 GT3, a very rare beast indeed in my competition now. Indeed. And that was driven, indeed crashed by Dirk Diggler. For those of you that don't know, Dirk Diggler is a character name from, I think, Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that is actually... the best motor racing story of the year, right there. You have sussed that one out, mate. All right. Well, we are now officially past the 1 hour mark. So why don't we cruise to the finale here of our approximate 90-minute show by jumping into General questions. And all right, I'll kick this one off, and then why don't you take some, brother? We'll start off with Brian McCoy via Facebook. He says, "Hey guys, love the show, especially the soapbox rants as well. We need one, by the way. We're lacking one, Graham. To most fans, the driver's championship, more so the manufacturer's championship, is what we typically remember and brag about amongst each other. How is the driver versus manufacturer championship viewed within a race team, specifically one with manufacturer backing?" And Brian, you've struck on something perfect, because I was just writing about it last night for the next issue of Racer Magazine, which contains all kinds of IMSA 2019 previews. And that topic was raised by Ford Chip Ganassi Racing GTLM team manager Mike O'Gara. And I posed to him, "Hey, so 2019 is meant to be the finale of this Ford GT project, 4 years coming to an end. Last year, obviously, the Corvette team ended up having success in winning the driver's championship and the team's championship. You guys won the manufacturer championship for Ford. Would I be safe in assuming that the driver's championship, something you have not won so far, would really be the big priority to want to get, and, you know, teams as well, before your swan song?" And he just had a great response, Brian, in saying that, you know, Chip Ganassi is all about adding trophies to the trophy display downstairs at our shop. The one trophy that isn't there is the manufacturer's championship, because that goes to Ford. So while we are incredibly happy to have captured that for Ford, and we know how much it means to them, and it means so much to us, we really want to fill in that trophy case for Chip with the drivers and the teams as well. So I would say there is a great sense of duty, Brian, among the manufacturer-backed teams. Those manufacturers, while they obviously want to win every championship available every season, if there's only one they can take home, the manufacturers, that is why they're there. We know that. I do love hearing from someone like Mike, and you'll hear it from every other team, that, hey, we want the team-based honors too, and that could be winning, you know, the championship with our drivers and so on. That is what means a lot to those in the trenches. There are some, you could say, some teams that are manufacturer-backed where, you know, they really are almost exclusively manufacturer first, meaning, hey, any of the team championships or driver championship, that'd be great, but honestly, we're almost, you know, solely focused on the manufacturer title.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, you know, that might also be a little bit of political correctness in being offered there, Graham. Ask the folks going over the wall, changing tires, refueling, turning wrenches, doing whatever, strapping those drivers in. They want not only all, but yeah, as a crew member, former crew member, driver's title, team's title, those are the things I've never won any of those, by the way, but those are the things that I always dreamt of, and getting one of those would be the thing that I'd be telling folks about in perpetuity, manufacturer title capturing would probably be a distant third.
I think the one thing I'd add to that, and Peter, don't disagree with a single word of it, is there may well be just the odd occasion where there is a driver of high enough profile, in other words, something that will create news headlines for that make, that might just come into play. Now, I can only think in the recent years, certainly in WEC, of maybe three that might have been in that kind of realm, and those three in no particular order are Fernando Alonso, it being, frankly, almost a given that Toyota will take the manufacturer's title anyway, Mark Webber and Patrick Dempsey. So those are three where there's no doubt in my mind. Look, the reason why those guys were involved with those makes, well, in two of the three cases, because of their God-given pace. In all three of those cases, it's because their involvement is highly newsworthy and therefore marketable. So that's the only balancing factor I would give. Yes, there are other drivers of equal or better quality that have been on the racetrack at the same time. But the reality is, even with a world title, etc., some of those names simply are not going to make the international headlines that pays back. And here's the third mention of this, the return on investment, that the fees in the case of two of them and the involvement in the case of the third bring to the luster of the manufacturer's involvement.
Where shall we go next, my friend? Time for you to take the baton.
Let's have a quick go at DC3's.
Let's have a go at DC3.
Yeah, disagree with you. WC Red, DC3, and season's greetings to MPMGG, and the same to you, my friend.
Yes.
And to you and yours. He's been thinking about the current state of motorsport journalism a fair bit. I think about that every single day.
So you've been depressed, reading DC3.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry.
Goes without saying, I consider the work both of you do to be a very high caliber. Also been thinking about highly I regard the work that Mark Hughes does for Motorsports Magazine, that is. It seems fit that DSJ's, Jenkinson's publication, is still producing some of the best long-form journalism in the world of Grand Prix racing. Whilst it's not necessarily a question confined to the world of sports cars, I'd like to ask who you consider your journalistic heroes. Which of your colleagues in the world of motorsport journalism do you consider to be the current masters of the craft? You want to go first with that one?
I'll let you go, and then I will ramble afterwards. And I'm going to go while you're talking. I'm actually going to step away for a moment and see if I can get our cat Rosie, who you might have heard meowing incessantly in the background, figure out what she needs to mellow out. So I will be back momentarily. Off you go,
tickle
Mr. Goodwin.
Tickle the chin. Well, Mike, I'm going to give you two, both of whom are somewhat elder statesmen in our little world. One, I've mentioned this before, I think, on the program, which is my founding editor at Daily Sports Car, my mentor, Malcolm Cracknell, who got involved in sports car journalism because he felt that the established order were not covering the sport he felt passionately about in enough depth and with enough of the flavor that he felt made this special. That eventually led from the mid-90s, when he packed in his job as a teacher to become a full-time journalist, to spooling through about 6 years later into what became Daily Sports Car. And he was our founding editor and navigated the initial choppy waters to the point where he retired in ill health and still in ill health. And Malcolm, I hope you're listening, and I hope you have a fantastic Christmas and New Year. And involved me in the early days of that. It gave me my break, gave me my opportunity to indulge my passion, which much, much later became a core of the full-time job. And I'm delighted that we've followed through on that and brought through young talent, both writing and photographic talent. Several award-winning young guys have been through our doors, and several of them are still with us. So he's number one. The other one, Michael Cotton, long-standing journalistic hero of mine with a long history working with some very, very big titles indeed, including motorsport. I'm delighted to say, proud to say, that Mike has done some work with us at DSC in recent years.
Fine, indeed.
With long-form interviews, which I hold dear, and I'd love to do more with him. Away from the kind of the motorsport, the sports car side of things, I think we've lost something in motorsport journalism in the last 10 years. The immediacy of the internet, whilst it does give you guys out there and us a chance to follow far more elements in the great sport that we've got, the immediacy also places some pressures that were not there in the same way before. This impetus to kind of keep producing stuff, you know, clickbait comes from that without a shadow of a doubt. The fact of the matter is, at the moment, the numbers count commercially more than they ever have before. So I think the mark of the real heroes here are the people that avoid the risk, the allure of playing to that pure numbers game and stick to their guns. And for me, you've mentioned Motorsport Magazine. It's great. I think they've been through a rocky period of time. They're effectively repopulating now after being under some level of attack from, you know, larger organizations out there. Racer Magazine, Paul Fanner and the crew, including UMP, I think have been just standard bearers in the North American marketplace. You get into, you know, the likes of Road and Track, etc. You know, it is those magazines that you'll pick up and read rather than pick up and flick through and find there is nothing there that you didn't already know. That, to me, is the mark of proper long-form journalism now, and I'm delighted we've still got some of them. If you love it, value it, buy it. Put your money down. Pay the whatever it is in whatever marketplace you are and pick up that magazine because you know what? It's not a given that they're going to be there forever.
I would say DC3, my answer is a fairly consistent one. The writers that I love most tend to be lean, more lyrical, tend to be ones that Nigel Roebuck has been my favorite for ever since I really started picking up on motor racing seriously for decades and decades. I think I mentioned this before. I still have a binder that I made that's about 3 or 4 inches thick where I went and photocopied all of his fifth columns from Auto Sport starting in the whatever mid-80s, something like that. Nigel has the ability to do something that we don't see as much of today as I wish we would have. I don't do a very good job of this, and I need to continually improve. And that is, he would and continues to bring either historical views or first-person opinions in a way that makes me feel, at least, like I am there and sitting next to him, standing next to him, just peering over his shoulder in that paddock, in that press conference. His ability to bring bring readers along for the ride and transport them thousands of miles away, possibly, to whatever it is he's talking about, or tens and twenties and dozens of years back to something that he witnessed. The ability to do more than just write about Gilles Villeneuve was great, but I saw Gilles Villeneuve do this. I spoke with him about that. It gave me the sense of this, the way that he, the emotions that poured from him really registered in this kind of way. Just, again, there's a bit of a flowing lyricism to this particular style of writing. And so for me, Nigel Roebuck, absolute standard bearer. I would have a hard time seeing how that would ever change. And it's something that I miss. I know that there are some, if we're looking at sports car racing specifically, there are some sports car outlets that do an excellent job of giving you, you know, real just black and white bullet point type stuff. This driver is going to be in this car. This team has hired this person. This team has changed its number from this to that. It's all great. It's awesome. Those little factoids are not the things that are going to sustain you or fill you if that's all you're getting, in my opinion. It's those who can paint these beautiful portraits, bring you inside and make you feel like you were there. That, to me, those are the things where truth appreciation flows. And so that's why I've loved Nigel Roebuck. My favorite writer, and actually I don't think I've mentioned this before, is a columnist for Car and Driver by the name of John Phillips. I work for and have my client Road and Track. I've been with them for more than a decade. Graham, Car and Driver is a sister publication under the same Hearst Publishing umbrella. you could think of them as a little bit of a rival Car and Driver to Road and Track. I will just freely admit that I subscribe to Car and Driver for one thing, and that is John Phillips' monthly columns. And I cut them out, much similar to what I did with Nigel's stuff and photocopying it, and I keep them because John Phillips' ability to use 600 words, 700 words, and tell the damnedest stories with the most amazing phrasing, the most amazing words and structure, the way his mind works, and the way that mind is distilled into a column about a car, a race, a personality, something, I will go to my grave dreaming of grasping how to be like John Phillips. I don't have it. I will never have it. But that's why, I guess, I love his work so much. And lastly, I'll throw in my Road and Track colleague, Sam Smith, who is younger and so much better. And he is definitely in that Roebuck, Phillips vein, phrasing, crazy phrasing, painting amazing pictures with words. Yeah, the folks who can take me away from whatever I am doing, wherever I'm sitting, whatever my present status happens to be, and just go to a place where I feel as if, I'm not talking out of body, but just you leave the world behind because their writing allows you to do that. Those are the ones that I tend to love. So Nigel Roebuck, John Phillips, Sam Smith, those are the ones that I would say definitely. If you're interested, if you're a journalist in training, someone who wants to do this, those would be three pretty amazing guides to emulate.
I'm going to add, by the way, because we have had a similar question this before, and I've just reminded myself that I owe one of our listeners a call back because of my ridiculous travel schedule and also some family issues that have kept me away from being as disciplined with my email.
Murphy
thanks,
the Bear.
By the way, David Harvey, by the way, thank you very much, because I did answer a question previously with this with my all-time journalistic hero, automotive journalistic hero, and that's Russell Bulgin, who all too early we lost Russell Bulgin to cancer, and there was an exchange about the limited edition book that was put together for by his friends in memory of him. And yes, David, I very much want to complete that conversation because that might just very well be the answer to a question I'm being asked by my good lady wife. What do you really want for Christmas this year? So let's wait and see how that one goes. Worth looking up Russell and his work online. There is some of it online. Equally, with all the guys you just mentioned there, extraordinary ability to just add life to, well, let's face it, a subject that sometimes can be written in all too formulaic a fashion.
I will grab the next question here, a little similar vein, from our friend Kinky Mosan via the WC Reddit group, who asked, how does one keep up with the rate at which the Week in Sports Cars is being issued? I know about a few guys that want to keep up but struggle a bit to squeeze Twisk into their daily schedule. On the same note, what is your guys' main motivator to sit down every week, gather all the questions from all the sources onto an enormous pile, and answer them with the enthusiasm you offer us at every episode? Should that motivator ever vanish, I hope it doesn't, would you still do the podcast or even motorsport journalism as an ordinary, mechanically done job? Well, and so this is me really realizing that my smart-ass trigger is being switched heavily. It comes out once a week, so I'm not sure about how you keep up with it, but I know that it comes out on a day of the week, and then it's usually about a week to the next one. So in theory of keeping up, there'd be, like, I don't know, about 6, maybe 7 days until the next one.
I think it's probably the point here is, damn it, keep to 90 minutes, is what he's basically saying there, but doing it really politely.
Yeah, I know that. I just couldn't have it. Yeah, so we're going to be trying to be better stewards of the 90 minutes And yeah, and then if not, we'll at least try and mention up front it's a giant episode because it could be the Rolex 24, Le Mans, whatever, something that naturally would be a bigger show in terms of length. But again, maybe we do just start going to the 90 minutes plus overtime. So, an overtime bonus episode later in the week to catch up with the other questions. So, tell us if you like that, if you think that works, and if so, we're always open to format modification. What about motivation, Graham? I mean, that's the next question.
I think the answer is that the genesis of this project was pretty simple, wasn't it? It was immediately post the post-race press conference at the Rolex 24. And it was, hey, what do you think about this as an idea? And immediately, because you and I like talking about this stuff. We like talking about this stuff. There was an enormous plus. I get this. I'm lucky enough to get this with my everyday working job. I work with people that I like and that I like to work with. And that applies to the team that we travel with worldwide with Daily Sports Car. It applies to the people I work with in broadcasting. And it applies to you, Marshall Pruitt, in terms of what we do with Twisk, the Week in Sports Cars. And, it doesn't mean that you have to agree with them. In fact, it quite often helps when you don't. But it does mean that we have a window in our lives with something that we are passionate about where we can relate to each other in a way that I'm afraid society is forgetting about. That is, we can have a debate. We can have a friendly argument. We can batter things around. We can have fun with it. We can take opposing views without falling out about something. And that, to me, is just, that's what makes being human, and it is a little window on my world when I'm not on a plane and I'm not mashing out copy and I'm not trying to get involved with the business side of the businesses that I'm involved with in motorsports, but I'm just basically having a conversation with a good buddy and interacting with some of you good people, which is one of the things I love doing the most, whether or not it's on social media, whether or not it's saying hello in the paddock. That is never a burden. There might be moments when I'm busy and I have to say, I'm really sorry, but I've got to run, literally, because I've messed up my timetable again. But I love seeing you guys in the paddock. It's an absolute joyful part of this. I'll tell you something that is a common factor between Marshall Pruitt and I. We've never forgotten how special and how much of a privilege it is to do what we do for full-time gainful employment. And that, I hope, shows through in the way that we deliver this podcast.
Absolutely. And I can actually, for the first time, share the reason why I wanted to do this Week in Sports Cars podcast with Graham, as the concept occurred to me just at the end of the 2018 Rolex 24. And it was actually something, a bit of advice that IMSA chief race steward Bo Barfield gave me. And it was sharing a piece of really big and important advice that he was given and that he uses. And he said, the one thing that I do every morning when I come into the paddock is I go and find the person that I like the least or I have the most problems with and say hello to them. And so I was just thinking, who is the most loathsome character that comes to mind that I could possibly interact with for about an hour and a half, sometimes two plus each week? And ding, ding, ding.
You
was sitting
them.
Right across from me. And so, I mean, man, two birds, one stone. That's honestly, it's just working out, some personal demons.
I'm crushed. I'm crushed.
A psychologist would say that I'm making good grounds here.
I'm crushed. I'm just looking for the off button. Where's the off button?
You served that one up too easily, my friend. I'm sorry. It's your fault. No, back to your question here. Truthfully, there are some podcasts that I do that feel like work. That's fine. I mean, work feeling like work, it's not exactly a foreign concept. But this doesn't feel like work. Graham and I have been friends for a good while. We do this kind of chatting and have done this kind of chatting on a regular basis before the podcast started. We do it whenever we're together at the racetrack. If anything, this is just a continuation of that in recorded and publicly presented form. Less cursing, You know, Graham talks about Hitler less here, which is a good thing. Yeah. You know, pornography isn't raised as frequently, you know, but all that stuff.
Don't show off top is a busted magazine.
Yes, exactly. And that's actually not a magazine featuring naked women. That's actually just folks in Florida who have been busted by the police and imprisoned. All joking aside, this is, it's just a fun extension of our friendship and relationship. By coincidence, he is a full-time reporter of sports cars, mostly on European/international-based series. I tend to be mostly North American-based. The two fit together very well. And here we go. Plus, you know, for the last couple of trips to Le Mans for me, and also when I covered the WC at Silverstone in 2015 as well, you know, really did that more as part of the DSC family and working more integrated with DSC then, obviously there on behalf of Racer and Road and Track. But yeah, it's just a friendship extended into podcast form. So that part's pretty easy. As for the motivation vanishing, I do hope that never happens. I can say that I've been involved in racing my entire life, genuinely, just even as a toddler or infant being dragged around to races. My professional career started, I think, 32 years ago, and I've maintained it this long, and there are enough foolish folks that keeps giving me reasons to do this and helping me to support my family in doing this. So I don't foresee the flame ever extinguishing. If it does, I can tell you that doing a podcast or journalist, you know, being a reporter or whatever, that part would very likely go away. Because if you are not doing this in motor racing, because it is a absolute peak passion, probably not going to be here that long.
Yep, I agree completely. Long may this continue. It is a highlight in my week. And, you know, you will be aware, dear listeners that have been with us for much of this crazy first year of the week in sports cars, that there have been challenges along the way in terms of, you know, external factors for both of our families and indeed the logistical challenges of it never wavered. There's never been a thought that we're not going to do this. And, you know, once we've got over those challenges, once we've got through that, I have to say, MP, this is 90 minutes or more of a highlight of the week for me.
Speaking of, we're at about that 90-minute mark. Shall we say farewell, or shall we grab one final quick and easy question
to answer? One apiece. Come on, one apiece. Let's
all
do
right.
that.
I'll grab Jeremy Gosch's. This is coming from Twitter, who asks, does the CJ Wilson team have any plans for next year, or did they simply fall off the face of the earth? Didn't fall off. They're still there, more focusing on the Porsche of Fresno dealership, I believe. We do know that the majority of the good folks that ran his team based out of Texas have essentially taken over, I don't want to say taken over, split with CJ, kept the assets, bought the assets, and have expressed their intention to continue racing using the Acura NSX GT3 that CJ Wilson Racing rolled out for a couple of IMSA WeatherTech races and GTD. They plan on doing that under the Gradient Racing banner. Was told that CJ would be announcing his racing plans. I believe those are going to be more amateur pro-am based than CJ Wilson's heading back to the WeatherTech Championship or similar. So haven't heard those plans, but I don't believe they're going to be the kind of medium to higher profile type things that he and the team have been doing in recent years. And off to you, Graham, for our final question.
We've got a number of Christmas-related questions. I'm going to choose one of them for the end of this particular kind of show.
Travesty.
We've got another one coming as a Christmas
show.
Travesty.
Show.
That's
got
a good
it.
One. I'm going to go to a new name for me as a questioner. So if this is your first time, you're more than welcome, Joshua Chrome, as from Facebook. If you guys could pick one racing item for Christmas to get from Santa, does he exist? Regardless of price, what would it be?
Well, you answer.
I'd have the Circuit de la Sarthe to myself with a car. just to practice. Just to practice. I've driven that circuit closed to traffic. I was lucky enough to get an offer to drive a very nice car indeed, an Aston Martin V12 Vantage around there between the qualifying sessions some years ago. And it was heaven. It was absolute heaven. To anybody that's passionate about this sport, to anybody that, you know, that feels that, I mean, that was my moment to drive down that main straight and under that Dunlop Bridge and down the Mulsanne Straight. I could do that over and over again. For me, that's the big, the macro thing of it. Beyond that, Alan Simonson's race suit from one of the races he won, that would be the other thing. Wow. That I miss Alan a lot. I have been known to get fairly emotional when thinking about that. But lots of happy memories with him on track, lots more happy memories with him off track, and in conversation. But that's the memento, the experience would be the opportunity to drive that track.
1987, Group 44, Jaguar XJR7. V12 IMSA GTP machine. That is what Santa should deliver. I'm not saying could, would, should. This is going out to Santa right now. Make that amazing, amazing machine appear somewhere nearby that I can just have and drive, even if I only get to 7/10 of its capabilities. Beautiful to look at. Incredibly gorgeous vehicle. The sounds, I've mentioned many times before, I believe it is that vehicle in particular, the best sounding V12 I have just about ever heard. So that's my dream. It's been my dream for decades. So Santa, I got to admit, man, like some of you who submit the same questions over and over again, and it takes a while, buddy, I've been submitting this request for 30 plus years, you know, about 30 years or so now, 31 years. You know, come on, man, time to deliver. So, but I think your pick, Graham, of something related to your dear friend Alan Simonson, that's a beautiful thought and also a beautiful way to farewell this episode. Say thank you to everybody on Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit.
Absolutely.
Who submitted questions, and I have done a very good job. I've been a good boy. I have highlighted all the questions that we have used, which will make it ever so easy for us to continue recording a bonus episode, holiday episode, of all of the remaining questions, and we're going to get to everyone. So the next episode, just saying, we're not putting a time limit on it. It's truly just, we want to make sure everyone who sent something in heading into the holidays gets their questions answered. It's not, those aren't gifts. Trust me, nothing we do here would be qualified as that valuable, but we just want to make sure that for those who don't fit the standard 90-minute format, we're going to get back to everything else that we did not capture here on the Weekend Sports Cars with our man Graham Goodwin from dailysportscar.com. What should we say?
We've got to say one more thing, which is our question of the week. Now, do you want me to select one from this week and you can do the second show?
Sure.
I'm going to go for, because it was just, it's a question that we've had in various forms, but just thought the timing was extremely good. And it's one of our Twitter questioners, and it's going to go to John McCarthy at To Catch the IF8, who asked about the whether or not Carcar will be the death knell to GT manufacturers.
Yeah,
gave us an opportunity
one.
To unpick that. And I will be in touch via Twitter, John, so we'll have to sort out how that works with direct messaging. And I will give you the choice of three fine automobiles that will be on offer. We'll be doing one for this show, one for the follow-up Christmas show, and one for next week's full edition. That will be the trio, and but John will be the first winner.
All right, well, we are done with the Week in Sports Cars on the good old Marshall Pruitt podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, and you'll be hearing from us in just a matter of days ahead of the holidays. Graham, thank you, my friend.
All good. Great stuff. Have a great week.